and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, baseball in the far north. Did you know that a lot of baseball greats cut their teeth in Alaska before making it big in the majors? Barry Bonds, Mariners pitcher Randy Johnson, the list goes on. Anchorage historian Katie Ringsmith talks about baseball in the far north this hour. The museum recently opened a new exhibit called Home Field Advantage. It's on display through November 1st. This is the first in a three-part centennial lecture series hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society. This talk was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on May 21st. Without further ado, here's historian Katie Ringsmith.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Jim and the Cook Inlet Historical Society for thinking that this topic warranted a place on the lecture series this year. This was truly a labor of love. I'm actually missing a baseball game today because I have two little boys who are avid ball players, so we're on the field a lot. Jim mentioned Terrence, and I really want to thank him because he provided much of his early research of baseball in Nome and Fairbanks and provided that to me. I also want to mention Jim Dietz, the longtime Alaska coach who oversaw many of the winning baseball teams here in Alaska, and he was great in helping me, provided information to me, and also the teams themselves who provided objects and wonderful stories. And of course, I need to thank my little boys, Ben and Tom, who bring the joy of this game home to me every day. And of course, I need to thank the Anchorage Museum. This is actually a really extraordinary opportunity, especially when you think of the centennial and why these kind of projects matter to us. Because here in Anchorage, we really can see how place transforms, how these spaces change over time. And where we're sitting right now...
Right here, Ringsmith leaves the microphone for a second. She is excitedly gesturing at a photograph of a baseball diamond, which, crazily enough, was in about the same spot as the Anchorage Museum's front lawn. The takeaway here is that baseball has been in Alaska for a very, very long time.
And place has a history, and I'm glad I'm going to be able to share this story with you tonight. Not long after the Knickerbockers faced the New York Nines in Hoboken, New Jersey on June 19, 1846, to play the first organized game in history, Americans would bring baseball to the far north. From the late 19th century onward, fans from Nome to Valdez, Unalaska to Ketchikan have embraced the game. Arriving settlers used baseball to create a sense of home in a unique northern landscape. But unlike fans in the lower 48, Alaskans engaged the sport in different ways. Freshly cut evergreen fields and youthful boys of summer rarely sparked reminiscence of baseball in the far north. Few Alaskans wax nostalgic of a bygone age. Alaskans carved diamonds from wilderness. We played ball at midnight and transformed baseball fields from ice and snow. Indeed, Alaskans played a more rugged style of baseball. So one of the first places in the far north where baseball was played competitively was on Herschel Island. Located on the Beaufort Sea, Herschel Island was one of the last refuges of the bowhead whale, which was prized by the American industry for the animal's baleen, blubber, and oil. Throughout the 1890s, icebound whalers at Herschel Island spread ashes on the sea ice to form a baseball diamond on which they played at 40 below, literally to pass the time. Seven clubs were organized and formed into a league called the Arctic Whalemen's Pennant. And these games went on all winter until the ships left for summer whaling in July. According to whaler Arthur James Allen, besides the whalemen team, several other nines occasionally arrived to compete. These players came from whaling towns of New Bedford, New London, and Martha's Vineyard. On this icy diamond, all were equal. Ship rank was set aside, and sailors could boss or coach captains without fear of retaliation. Apparently, ice conditions did not encourage very good defensive play. For in one game, the Roaring Gimlets vanquished the Pig Stickers by a score of 62-49. Indeed, these games were no idle pickup games. As Allen wrote, we had baseball books, and the games were played strictly according to the rules. Umpires and scorekeepers were appointed, and the minutes of each game were carefully kept. Gambling was a popular byproduct of the Arctic whalemen's pennant. Sailors carried the crow's nests from ships to the ball fields and used them as betting booths. Bets included exchange of Inupiaq boots, underclothing, socks, blankets, tobacco, pipes, shirts, and caps. Eyewitness to such activities was Brigadier General Frederick Funston, who arrived at Herschel Island after a snowshoeing trip across northern Alaska in 1894. All winter, regardless of blizzards and bitter cold, noted Funston, the games went on, three or four each week. In 1899, General Funston wrote an article about the Whalers Baseball League for Harper's Roundtable. It was reproduced by Albert G. Spaulding in his game-changing 1911 classic, Baseball, America's National Game. In the book, Spaulding featured a drawing entitled Baseball in Alaska, and the image, based on photographs taken by Funston, show the whalemen playing on the ice. Both the article and image highlight the spectators, those who Funston called the typical baseball cranks. But not so typical, and perhaps even completely unexpected, from where these spectators came. As Funston points out, places such as the Bering Strait, Point Barrow, and far, far beyond. I saw was the crowd of several hundred people watching our national sport. As this faraway corner of the earth, only 20 degrees from the pole and thousands of miles from railroads or steamship lines. And this crowd was more widely cosmopolitan than could have been found at any other place on the globe. Observers like General Funston and later Spaulding assumed baseball to be newly introduced to the indigenous people of the North, but this wasn't exactly the case. Indeed, the desire and satisfaction of hitting a ball with a large stick is universal. You can ask my son. He went around hitting things before he knew what baseball was. Archaeologist Frederica de Laguna found evidence of such games in Ketchumek Bay, Kodiak, and the Aleutians. And before Americans brought their version of baseball northward, Alaska Natives played a game described as a mix of cricket, dodgeball, and baseball. People living in the Arctic region collectively call this Eskimo ball, and people inhabiting the southern areas call the game Laptic or Aleutic ball. So the indigenous version of baseball likely came to Alaska through two different routes. The Russians introduced to the Inungan and the Aleutic people of coastal Alaska this ancient batting game called Lapta, which dates back to the 14th century. By the late 19th century, Sami reindeer herders from northern Scandinavia introduced to Inupiaq and Yupik people a game they called Lapball. Now, these two versions likely came from the same Siberian source, but it would be really fun to do a little bit more research on this. Historically, indigenous baseball is tied to colonization, but generations of Alaskans passed down this game and shaped and molded it into a cultural expression of their own. Elders from New Wallach recall how as children they used driftwood as a bat and any kind of small rubber ball to play Aleutic ball. Today, kids in Kodiak still celebrate the arrival of Easter with a game of Aleutic ball. Kids in Barrow play what they call Eskimo ball at recess, even in winter. Whether it's called Lapshur and Ozinki, Lapchuk and Antioch, or Pepik and Nualik, one thing remains constant, that this Siberian game has been absorbed culturally and is now claimed as distinctly Alaska Native. The game continues to have a presence in villages everywhere. Indigenous baseball instills among residents one observer described as a feeling of togetherness, which participants, players, and spectators alike share. So when Americans came to explore, mine, fish, or work in the railroad, they brought with them baseball. During the Gold Rush era, no miners scraped away soggy vegetation from the surface of ancient beach ridges, placed hundreds of burlap bags atop the permafrost, and then piled dirt atop the bags in order to craft a playable ball field that overlooked Dry Creek. Historian Terrence Cole described the Nome Field as one of the most unique ballparks in the world. The Nome Baseball Association was formed to promote the game in the summer of 1908. It was headed by J.C. Gaffney, the owner of the Nome Clothing Store, and other businessmen in the city who enjoyed watching the grand old game. Their achievement was improving the baseball park, about which one newspaper man remarked, "It was not believed that such a good infield could be made in this country." Rather quickly, with the help of baseball, Nome transformed from a mining camp into an American community. In June, the Nome Gold Digger reported that when the Reds and the Colts met, the Colts outclassed the Reds in the field, but Nakbar, the Colts pitcher, made monkeys of them all. He had a high ball with a slight twist that kept their heaviest batters swinging their heads off. Rounding out the Nome teams were Fort Davis and the Federal Labor Union. In Anchorage, Alaska artist Sidney Lawrence photographed a baseball game on July 4, 1915. The year the railroad town was founded. Over 100 spectators lined an area from first base to third. Behind the perfect diamond and the spacious outfield stood a tent city, and behind that, the seemingly impenetrable Alaska wilderness. Baseball in the early 20th century was an extension of American culture, and consequently, the baseball diamond became a platform on which not only the game itself, but politics, social values, and public agenda played out. And touching everything and everyone in the mid-19-teens was the Great War. According to the Anchorage Times, this war had been the cause for strife and dissension in business houses, banking houses, families, and even baseball. Anchorage residents responded to the strife by organizing drives. There was the drive to get the boys out of the trenches by Christmas and the Red Cross drive to raise money for the war orphans. One of the drivingest places in the whole USA, according to Alaska sportsmen, was the infant town that the old-timers still called Kinnick Anchorage. In the summer of 1918, residents pitched in once again in support of the Anchorage Women's Club Red Cross Drive. The club orchestrated a benefit variety show, a bake sale, a dance attended by practically everyone in town, as well as the Red Cross Tag Day. Now, punctuating their charity event was the benefit baseball game between the Elks and the Masons, and it was played on the field right here where we're sitting today. According to Mrs. Robarts, the benefit game was played on the day before the opening of the regular season for the Anchorage Baseball League, so just about 100 years ago, or not quite 100 years, but right about this time of year. So the winner was granted a cribbage board made from walrus tusk with a gold plate inscribed with the names of the team members. The game proceeds netted the war committees $250 each. Now, besides rallying Alaskans to support the war effort, baseball reflected the reform movement of the early 20th century. Change came as Alaskans began to challenge the traditional blue laws, which banned non-church-going activities on Sundays, including baseball. Articulating the stance against the blue laws was the editor of the Fairbanks News Miner, who argued that Alaskans needed, quote, an outlet of surplus enthusiasm. Every Tannenite is overcharged with oxygen and needs a view, therefore, advocated the editorial. If the camp cannot drink or listen to music, then we will go to church in the afternoon and play baseball in the evening during the hour when our church is not working. Baseball, these progressive thinkers argued, helped to strengthen the individual, both physically and morally. It is recognized that manly sports are essential to the right development of both body and mind, reported the Nome Daily Nugget in 1908. Like reformers nationwide, Alaska pundits sought balance between spirituality and good sport. Again, the Nome Daily Nugget argued, the preacher, taking a fair and liberal view of the situation, says, enter into your sport heartily, play all, or root and root loud. When you have enjoyed the sport thoroughly, then remember that there is another side to man's nature which calls for a quiet hour and thoughtful meditation on subjects that pertain to the higher nature of man. Well, Alaskan readers would have been aware of the pitfalls of playing on the Sabbath, thanks to the nationally popular Reverend Billy Sunday, himself an ex-ball player that had given into vice. Sunday warned worshipers against the sin of playing on the Sabbath, but Alaska pundits reasoned that logistically, if baseball is to be played between teams living in different towns, the game must be played at a time when the teams can be brought together. So in the end, Alaskans were finally allowed to enjoy a game of baseball on Sunday. Play ball, wrote the editor of Nome, but don't forget the church. So originally, baseball accompanied settlers who came to Alaska to make a living. In turn, baseball helped transform isolated work camps into integrated American towns. Teams were supported by local fraternal clubs and professional organizations. Residents turned out for games with enthusiasm, particularly the 4th of July tournament, the celebration's centerpiece. We are all enthusiastic American citizens, wrote Valdez prospector and ballplayer Joe Bork in 1898. At least we pretend as such. As town identities emerged, spirited rivalries formed among communities, linking Alaskans across the territory. Juneau, Douglas, Ketchikan, Sitka, Skagway, Cordova, Seward, Nome, Fairbanks, they all supported baseball teams. Anchorage was described as a very sports-minded city from its inception. There were three baseball teams which created friendly rivalries during their first few years. The Railroad Commission supported one team, the city of Anchorage another, and the third by Robarts Shamrocks. Robarts was a local bar owner who dressed his players in Patty Green colored uniforms. Anchorage women were not just spectators, but had a league of their own decades before their counterparts in the lower 48 did during World War II. The women teams often played against the men, who created a handicap by batting left-handed or would run the bases in the opposite direction. Now, fans and players alike would ride the Alaska Railroad, likely some of the very first passengers, to play teams beyond Anchorage. One account, 1916, describes the growing rivalry between Anchorage and Seward, in which a diehard players and fans sailed up Turnagain Arm, then pumped themselves on hand cars along the tracks most of the way to Seward. The Anchorage team lost the game, but the Anchorageites remained enthusiastic for the sport. The entire citizenship of Anchorage, wrote the Anchorage Daily Times, welcomes the all-Anchorage baseball team back home and wants them to know that the city is behind them from now on until the last man is out in the ninth inning and the final game. So summing up early Anchorageites' relationship to baseball was Anchorage Women's Club member Mrs. Robarts, who retold the story of a young woman named Inez Sharpless, who expressed a little apathy about residents' enthusiasm for baseball. But after she lived in Anchorage a while, explained Robarts, she fully understood why everything is so vital in a small, isolated community, far from the outside world. Now, while the game helped to Americanize towns across the territory, the extreme northern environment set Alaska apart from its national counterpart. Since the first pitch in 1906, teams assembled at Fairbanks Ballpark to compete in the famous Midnight Sun Game. Fairbanks' long midsummer days allowed for the game to be played under the natural light of the midnight sun, something that would not be done in the lower 48 for decades. Witnessing the unusual late evening start time was considered an Alaskan rite of passage, as journalist H.C. Jackson explained in a 1913 article for Sunset Magazine. Oops, let me go back here. Here, this camp was hold that besides seeing freeze up and watching the ice go out in the spring, a chechako must sit through a midnight ball game before he can class himself a sourdough. In Fairbanks, the Daily News Miner proclaimed that the national pastime is as popular here as anywhere under the flag. And every season, several good ball teams are organized. But just when it kind of looks to the reader that the Fairbanks newspaper is boasting just how American Alaska baseball is, the article kind of shifts focus to highlight the differences between Alaska baseball and the rest of the country, noting particularities such as place, distance, and time. The Fairbanks newspaper noted, many games are played in the evening, notable among them being the annual Midnight Sun Game on June 21st, when playing ball is called a little before 12 o'clock, and the game throughout is played with satisfactory light conditions. Talk about distance, teams from Dawson, continued the article, distant nearly 1,000 miles, occasionally would come to Fairbanks to engage in a series of games. And the soldiers from Fort Gibbons, 275 miles away, play here annually. So Alaska's rugged landscape also dictated how the game was played in the far north, which certainly set it apart from the lower 48. In southeast Alaska, baseball's themes of rebirth and renewal were not just underscored seasonally, but twice a day, as Ketchikan's teams competed on a diamond built on the tidal flats where Ketchikan Creek flows into the Tongass Narrows. Though fans were accustomed to the game's unhurried rhythms and timeless pace, the mighty Pacific Ocean was not. Matches that went too long were often called on account of the rising tide rather than nine innings, and each time that ball field was made anew. Maybe they can do that with MLB to try to pick up the games, just have an ocean flow in. So probably the most rugged of games was actually played at Kennecott, out on the Kennecott Glacier. So that's not earth clumps that these fans are perched on. It's actually gravel covered in glacial ice. In fact, the photographer is standing on the glacier, photographing the teams playing. So the uniqueness of Alaska baseball was quickly trumpeted and often exaggerated in tourist pamphlets by scribes to promote the exotic nature of Alaska to the outside. In 1908, for example, a journalist wrote, "With the blistering rays of the midnight sun beating down upon them, and their every move followed intently by a crowd of wild fans whose enthusiasm held them in the oven-like bleachers and grandstands, the pick of Alaska stars of the diamond played faultless ball last night in a desperate fight for the odd score that would win the laurels in this most important game of the Tanana season. The Arctic Brotherhood men won by an eyelash, the final score standing 3-2. I don't know. I've been up in Fairbanks, and I don't know if blistering at midnight is what I'd call it. And in the far north, baseball wasn't sequestered into summertime. Alaskans played baseball year-round. During the winter of 1900, a team of soldiers battled a squad from the Alaska Commercial Company in mid-February. It was so uncomfortable that the pitcher from the Alaska Commercial Company, Lois L. Lane, froze his fingers, and the contest was postponed until the arrival of milder weather. So Alaska's most severe weather simply just moved the game inside, preceding basketball and volleyball as Alaska's favorite indoor sport. "Modern as it seems," wrote Terrence Cole, "the idea of bringing baseball indoors is not new. Ironically, indoor baseball eventually evolved into the most widely played team sport in the United States, softball. And unlike baseball, which demands quick reflexes, the agility of youth, and is largely played by men, softball is a game for both sexes and people of all ages." Now, finally, the most fitting example of the overlap between baseball and the northern environment comes from Dawson City in the Yukon Territory, when the Gold Rush boomtown was once the final stop for new movies and newsreels. The films accumulated at Dawson's library until the town decided that the nitrates in the collection posed a significant fire risk. The solution? Dump the film reels into a hole, fill it with water, and turn it into a hockey rink. Typical Canadians, right? So when the library was expanded in 1978, the reels were rediscovered in near perfect condition. The collection was eventually excavated and sent to Ottawa until a New York researcher came across one reel just casually titled the 1919 World Series. Now, for those of you who may not know this story, the 1919 World Series would move Shoeless Joe Jackson and the infamous Black Sox beyond the sports page, securing them a tragic place in American history. And thanks to the permafrost, the northern environment preserved a piece of baseball history itself. And you can all see this footage if you happen to go up to the fourth floor and visit the Home Field Advantage exhibit here at the museum. Pretty cool, actually. So the U.S. military was another important baseball conduit, transporting the game to the farthest reaches of the Northern Territory. Forts and bases often built fields and supported teams. During World War I, the Anchorage Daily Times asked readers to send baseball paraphernalia to troops in France. Baseball, according to the paper, gave idle soldiers a modicum of amusement and kept them out of trouble. Most importantly, baseball ensured, according to the paper, that the American soldier did not forget his country's customs and traditions. The 1917 article went so far to predict that sports will win the war. In World War II, a national advertisement appeared in Life and National Geographic, and it illustrated a scene in which the U.S. soldiers shared two homegrown products with Alaska Natives, Coca-Cola and baseball. Beyond the acculturalization and economic interventionism implied in the ad, there's also this more subtle message. The message addressed the question that perhaps a soldier's family back home might ask. How do our sons deal with being sent to a place that most of them imagine to be a foreign and distant land? The answer, baseball. Indeed, baseball represented normalcy to soldiers stationed in the far-flung Aleutian Islands, far from familiar hometowns. Along with weapons, artillery, and other necessary armaments for war, the enlisted men considered baseball gear a priority. Playing baseball helped these soldiers, many of them just kids, 18, 19 years old, help them to cope with the pressure of war. So, no matter where the game is played, race and baseball often collide, both on and off the field. In Alaska, early missionaries introduced baseball to Native youth, in part to assimilate them to American culture. The Department of Interior's Bureau of Education, which maintained schools for Alaska Native children, instructed nurses to have the Native children play baseball basketball and tennis, as well as the games of the natives for the purpose of health and sanitation. Such attitudes coalesced with those of the Alaska progressives who believed not only do the games develop the athletics and the athletes who participate, but are an inspiration to the younger generation to follow up wholesome outdoor sports. Likewise, mining camps and salmon canneries, even in places like Bristol Bay and Southeast Alaska with racially diverse employees, used baseball as a way to address conflict and to build camaraderie among crews. From Japanese sailors to Filipino slimers, the presence of Asian players was pronounced. An old Japanese-American team from the Pacific Northwest even traveled up the Inside Passage to challenge teams from the Alaskan coastal communities. In Anchorage, players who were forbidden to play baseball in the lower 48 found opportunity for both work and play with the Alaska Railroad. And the issue of race certainly underscored one of Alaska's great sports moments when Alaskans welcomed the legendary pitcher Satchel Paige to Anchorage in 1965. Now, 65, think about it, that's a turbulent year in America. Civil rights demonstrators just marched from Selma to Montgomery. Congress passed the Voting Rights Act. And indeed, Satchel Paige, no stranger to discrimination. He had pitched his way to stardom in the segregated National Negro League, and he became the oldest rookie in American Major League Baseball after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947. Paige came to Anchorage to play in a four-game expedition series in Mulcahy Stadium just 1 year after the Great Alaska Earthquake. Rumor had it that the legendary pitcher might manage a team named for the natural disaster. Now, I have to say, it took me forever to find this program. Lou Friedman told me that it existed, and he said that he got it from a guy named Pat Osborne and didn't know anything more than that. So I wrote a letter to every Pat Osborne I could find in Alaska. And this guy, he said, yeah, I got it. Not only do I have the program signed by Satchel Paige, but I got the baseball, too. So both of those items are on display, too. Pretty cool. And then he also wrote a story about what it was like to meet Satchel Paige, an 11-year-old boy in Alaska, or in Anchorage. So that was pretty neat. I loved Anchorage at first sight, Paige told the Daily News Miner. And I'm the man who can build this team up. I'm the man who knows the baseball players and can get them to come up here to play. Well, Paige has promised to start building a new Anchorage Earthquaker team the minute he left Alaska. Never panned out, but his presence in Alaska helped to draw interest in the new Alaska Baseball League. All right. Everybody stand up.
Let's go ahead and call this the seventh inning of the lecture. Katie Ringsmith asks everybody in the audience to stand up for a round of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. The voices of your fellow Alaskans have been augmented with the pipes of Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly here.
All right, here we go.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. Cause it's one,
two,
three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
I can't believe I just sang in front of people. You can tell that's not going to make me a living. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. That's right. Okay, so the Alaska Baseball League started with the Alaska Gold Panthers, founded by Henry Red Boucher and Don Dennis in 1960. The team assembled some of the best collegiate talent in the country, which over the decades included Greg Nettles, Dave Kingman, Bob Boone, Bill Spaceman Lee, and Dave Winfield. I actually got to talk to Dave Winfield on the phone. I was so nervous that I couldn't remember my phone number, so he probably thought I was a ding-a-ling, but it was pretty cool. My husband was really impressed. So the Gold Panthers won six national baseball conferences in the 1970s and 1980s, and most of those titles were won under the leadership of renowned coach Jim Dietz. In fact, it was Winfield who told me that it was Jim Dietz who made his career. He came up a pitcher, but Dietz recognized his skill set and turned him into a position player, and he was destined for the Major League Hall of Fame after that. Now, arguably one of the most famous of the players to come up to the Alaska Baseball League was Tom Seaver, who started pitching for Fairbanks in 1964. Now, according to Seaver himself, baseball had also a significant impact on his Hall of Fame career. In a letter to Red Boucher dated October 31, 1969, Seaver wrote, "To me, the Cy Young Award is the most important award a pitcher can attain. And I realize that my success is due to hard work, concentration, hard work, the right attitude, hard work, and of course, opportunity. And your program, Red, was a vital step in my progress towards reaching a world championship and especially the Cy Young Award in 1969. In 1969, the same year Seaver won the Cy Young Award, pitching for the New York Mets, the league expanded to Anchorage. The Glacier Pilots, named in honor of pilot and team supporter Bob Reeve, came out strong that year. They bested the Gold Panthers at the National Baseball Conference and became the first Alaska baseball team to win a national championship. The league expanded once again in 1974 with the founding of the Peninsula Oilers, who later became famous for their Bingo Hilton. The Hilton housed opponents as well as paid the bills. And by 1976, the wonderfully named Valley Green Giants started in Palmer. God, I love it. And the equally great-named North Pole Knicks formed to compete against the Gold Panthers. Now, despite the magnificent mascots, Big Vegetables and Santa Claus, only in Alaska, right? The Valley Green Giants and the North Pole Knicks folded and were eventually replaced with other teams in the region. Particularly the Mattsu Miners and the Cook Inlet Bucks, who of course now are the Anchorage Bucks. I love that program. That's pretty cool. So the Alaska Baseball League added the Chinooks in 2012. Over the decades, Alaska has proven to be a spawning ground for Major League ballplayers. The list of Hall of Famers include Tom Seaver, Dave Winfield, and of course, Randy Johnson, who's going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame this August. Other well-known names, and then just throwing just a few of them out there, include Harold Reynolds, Jacoby Ellsbury, Jason Jacoby, Tony Francona, Mark McGuire, Jared Weaver, Barry Bonds, and most recently, James Paxton, who I think pitched the other night for the Mariners. He's just getting a little better, so that makes me feel better. So these are just a few of the examples of the Major League players who found fame under the midnight sun. But ever since, the whalers, the explorers, the miners, the railroad workers, the soldiers imported baseball to Alaska, the game's greatest ambassadors, quite frankly, are kids. William Mulcahy introduced Little League Baseball to Anchorage in 1950. Mulcahy had served with distinction as chairman of City Parks and Playgrounds Commission. He earned national recognition for promoting good citizenship through sports. The city's newly renovated baseball park was named in his honor. And by the 1960s, American Legion gave boys 18 and other opportunity to play ball. In 1968, the city's Babe Ruth program sent the first team to represent Alaska at the Northwest Regional Tournament. Now, this is likely the very first sport team to represent Alaska at the national level. They didn't win, they lost, and Lee Jordan told me they got these little bats, which are also on display, which he called the heartbreak toothpicks. But Alaska team hadn't gone until 2013 which is actually has one of the kids' jerseys displayed next to Tom Seaver's. And I'll tell you, when I asked Bill if I could have his son's jersey on display at the museum and it'd be next to Tom Seaver, oh my gosh, you couldn't wipe the grin off his face. It was pretty cool. Even artist Fred Mocatons has a baseball connection. He, of course, is famous for his paintings of frontier Alaska, but in 1942, he illustrated a book about baseball called Steady, A Baseball Story, and these delightful stylized sketches were used to teach young people the skills of the game. So even I know, isn't he so cute? So whether in New York or Alaska, at the end of the day, the real meaning for baseball is childhood. Kids remind us why baseball makes us better people. The development of patience, teamwork, good sportsmanship. Kids transcend the emotion and beauty of this game. We fill the sport through them, from recalling the pure joy of catching our first fly ball to the heartbreak of being the last out. More than any of us, kids appreciate baseball's universal qualities, that it's fun, that it facilitates change, and mostly, it brings us together. So when newcomers arrived in the North, they brought with them the game of baseball. The new arrivals carved fields from wilderness, recreating a sense of home in a foreign place. But within those familiar diamonds, they encountered a unique northern landscape over which, through the years, transformed this game into something distinctly Alaskan. Collectively, these stories tell us that Americans might have brought the national pastime to Alaska, but we Alaskans, echoing the words of Walt Whitman, made it our game. Although when summer comes, we tend to worry more about sockeye salmon returning safely home than base runners. But perhaps the game is beloved by Alaskans because baseball, like the last frontier itself, is about heroes, renewal, and second chances. Baseball, writes sports historian John Thorne, served as a beacon, revealing a path through the wilderness. Indeed, the game was brought, played, and passed on to the next generation by dissimilar people filled with similar hopes and dreams, who, in the end, see salmon and ball players with the same goal. They both want to complete a cycle, get home safe, and score. So this summer, when not fishing, hiking, or camping, grab the kids, this is my little one, and head out to the ballpark. Then swing on by the museum, check out the exhibit Home Field Advantage, and experience baseball, Alaska style. All right, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Anchorage historian Katie Ringsmith. This talk was called Home Field Advantage, Baseball in the Far North. If you liked what you heard, there's a full exhibit at the Anchorage Museum on all things Alaska baseball. It'll be on display through November 1st. This talk was hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society. It was recorded May 21st at the Anchorage Museum. Thanks for tuning in with us this week on Addressing Alaskans. Until next week, I'm your host and producer, Monica Gokey.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.